Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. My name's David Clegg, I'm the editor of The Courier, and you join me on the day it is exactly 6 years from the independence referendum, or as Nicola Sturgeon would say, a generation since the independence referendum. I am joined by some of the biggest brains from across the DC Thompson newspaper portfolio. Joining me from The Courier, I have our political correspondent, Derek Healy. And from our, well, from across our stable, I have our data guru, Leslie Ann Kelly. And from the Press and Journal, I have their Westminster correspondent, Dan O'Donoghue, and their political editor, Tom Peterkin. We'll be talking about a few quite familiar issues, but there has been quite significant developments in all of them this week. It's been a very busy week. But I thought we would start with the story that is leading both the print editions of the Press and Journal and the Courier this morning, which is the latest twist in the long-running saga about Alex Salmond and the various divisions within the SNP regarding the First Minister. Tom Peterkin, I will bring you in here as it was you that was writing the story. It is a long, protracted and pretty complicated situation. We're all familiar with the background about the original sexual harassment allegations and complaints made about Mr. Salmond dating from his time as First Minister, the botched government investigation into those complaints, and the subsequent criminal trial, which is of which Mr. Salmond was acquitted of all counts. We now have this parliamentary inquiry, which is going on, and there was another evidence session about that on Tuesday. But there's also been there's been another development on that out with the actual parliamentary inquiry. Can you bring us up to speed with what's been going on?
That's right, David. So on the one hand, we've had the normal session of the parliamentary inquiry into Mr. Salmond, which on its own was very interesting in itself. And we had the former permanent secretary, who is Scotland's most senior civil servant, from much when Alex Salmond was first minister. Basically, he told the committee, the Holyrood committee, that Mr. Salmond had displayed bullying and intimidatory behaviour. He refused to be drawn on whether he told Nicola Sturgeon about this under repeated questioning, but he also said that there was no indication of any sexual misconduct on the part of the former First Minister. So we've had these really very interesting session at the committee, but at the same time, yesterday, we were working, yourself and I, on this story about leaks of electronic messages, WhatsApp messages, which relate to the Alex Salmond trial. Now, these are messages which appear to show Nicola Sturgeon's husband, Peter Murrell, who is also the chief executive of the SNP, backing police action against Mr. Salmond. Now, that's obviously a can of worms, you would think, is about to be opened here. And what we found out after we approached Police Scotland, who told us that the actual leaking of these WhatsApp messages is now the subject of a police investigation, which is a very interesting development when it is considered that Mr. Salmond's legal team were passed a dossier by the Crown as part of his criminal trial, which is, as you've said, he was cleared of all sex offence charges. But for these messages to make it into the public domain is a very serious matter indeed. And the statement we got from the police said, "The Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service has instructed us to investigate the potential unlawful disclosure of material inquiries at an early stage." So this is a rather intriguing and, I feel, important development.
The issue that we have with this whole Salmond saga, and we've found this at several places, It couldn't be more in the public interest getting to the bottom of what went on. Not just in regards to Mr. Salmond's own behaviour in office, but the culture and the environment and how the government dealt with or handled those types of behaviours. And reporting this is a very challenging legal climate. We were keeping our lawyers very busy last night, and we have to be very careful what we say here as well, obviously, because there's elements of this where we know more of the detail than we are actually able to make public. But what has happened is that some private communications between staff members of the SNP relating to this trial that happened earlier in the year were given to Mr. Salmond's defence team as part of the disclosure process in that trial. And somehow they have also found their way to Kenny McCaskill, the former Justice Secretary, who's passed them to the Crown Office and the committee which is investigating at the Scottish Parliament. So you have the one issue, which is they pretty clearly, on the face of it, seem to show that Nicola Sturgeon's husband was supportive or encouraging of police action against Mr. Salmond, which is obviously pretty explosive in regards to the developing splits between supporters of Nicola Sturgeon and supporters of Alex Salmond within the nationalist movement in Scotland. But there's also this issue of how those text messages have become public, and whether there's been a criminal disclosure of them at some point or in some place. That is a very complicated situation, and it couldn't be a more serious situation. Where does it leave this inquiry? Because it's very difficult to get to the bottom of exactly what's going on, isn't it?
In terms of the inquiry, just on the most basic level, there is going to be an enormous amount of interest when Alex Salmond appears in front of it, when Peter Murrell appears in front of it, when Nicola Sturgeon appears in front of it. I mean, this is going to be big occasions in the Scottish Parliament with a huge amount of media interest. On the possibly more important question of what is this inquiry going to uncover? That's a much more difficult question to answer. Already we've seen the inquiry struggle to get all the information it wants from the Scottish government. And in terms of how this plays out in the SNP, I mean, we've still got a long way to go on that as well. We've obviously got these two rival camps, the Salmond and Sturgeon, once, you know, incredibly close as politicians, but now their supporters are, you know, it's two factions within the SNP, and what impact that has on the SNP as a party as a whole. I mean, I suspect we've still got a long way to go on that.
One of the interesting things about this is, I think, for understandable reasons, because of the coronavirus pandemic and just the nature of life in Scotland over the last 6 months, this type of thing, or this particular issue, hasn't had the same level of coverage, and I think the same level of public absorption as you would normally expect. Whenever we were working on this late last night to try and get what we could in the paper and on the website. When you think of the cast list, when you think of the people who are in conflict, you know, Peter Murrell, Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond, Kenny McCaskill, these people were the central nucleus of that really tight and committed SNP team that drove the independence project to that 2014 referendum, which we're going to discuss later in the podcast. And to see them clearly at war with each other in this way is pretty astonishing, especially for people who saw up close just how tight a unit they were operating as and at that time.
Yeah, no, that I remember I'd been away from Scottish politics for a bit, but I came back to Scotland in 2008, which is a long time ago now. But when I left Scotland, the SNP were in opposition and tearing themselves apart. And then when I came back, I just could not believe how tight a unit it was in terms of the party discipline and how disciplined, I mean, almost to an unhealthy level, that there was so little dissent in the ranks. And now to see all this happening now is just incredible. But then the other irony is that despite all this, they're still out in front in the polls.
Yes, indeed. They're the dominance of the SNP under Nicola Sturgeon looks undiminished, and her steering of the COVID crisis seems to improve her popularity even more. So again, I guess that's why the evidence session, particularly with Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond, are going to be so interesting when they come at some point in the autumn. And we'll be following that at the Courier and the Press and Journal, and of course on the Stooshy podcast. I'll maybe move on at this stage if just because our lawyers have been so overworked already this week that I don't want to give them any more palpitations by talking about this too much more. We'll move on to that COVID issue, and I'll bring Leslie Ann Kelly in at this stage, because it feels like the second wave is pending, and it feels like we could be in for a bumpy few weeks, if not months. You've been covering the coronavirus stats every day for almost 6 months now, Leslie Ann. What are you slightly concerned about what you've been seeing the last few days?
Yeah, I mean, I was concerned last week when I spoke about it on the podcast, and I'm still concerned now. It feels very much like we're back in that time frame of where we were back in May time, where we were still seeing quite a lot of cases. I mean, when you look at the statistics for yesterday, we had 290 cases, which is the highest it's been since actually early May, which is really quite troubling. And when you look at the percentage positive, we hit a new high in terms of since we've come out of lockdown of 4%, which is the highest it's been since June the 1st. And just to remind everyone, there's a kind of magic line in the sand of 5%, which is where the WHO says you need to be under that to keep your kind of country out of lockdown. Essentially, it's a bit more complex than that, but that's the kind of general gist of it. So we were 3.4% or something, I think, last week when I spoke about it on the podcast. 4% now. It's going in the wrong direction. And testing, there's obviously issues with testing right now as well. People getting capacity to, I mean, I think, I can't remember who it was yesterday, but someone said in a committee it's not test and trace, it's more like trace a test, which does seem to be an issue. Testing numbers have been trending down since the beginning of the month. When you look at the 2nd of September, the 7-day average for testing was just above 23,000 tests in Scotland. Yesterday it was 15,000. So we've reduced the number of people that were testing every day in Scotland by a third since the start of the month, which obviously isn't great with the schools being back and universities now being back.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, I was concerned last week. I'm still concerned now.
What about the hospital admissions and ICU numbers? Are they starting to move in a worrying way, or are we not seeing that quite yet?
It's difficult with the hospital admissions because we've just this week changed the definition of them, so it's now difficult to see trends in that for a good few weeks to a month now because of how we've changed the definition of that. There was a report in the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford by Carl Hennigan, where he questioned whether countries like Scotland and Wales were over-reporting the number of hospital cases of COVID that there were. And I think they probably were. I think decisions have been made along the way as to how we record things, and they're statistical definitions, they're not clinical definitions. At no point have doctors been sitting down going, right, that person is still suffering from COVID, that's why they're in hospital. These are all just, these will be kind of ticks somewhere in the NHS system. And the numbers have been a bit fudged, essentially, because the old definition, if someone came into hospital, got a COVID test, left hospital, came back for something completely unrelated, they would be counted as a COVID hospitalisation under the old method.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a bit problematic. The new definition, it goes with an end date on it. So 28 days after your test, you would no longer be considered a COVID hospitalisation. That's obviously has its pluses and minuses in terms of the methodology, because as we know, we've seen in Tayside, for example, we've seen people who've been in the ICU for 3 months
sure.
before they've come out. And after 28 days, that person would no longer be considered a COVID ICU case. So
that does seem odd.
Yeah, the methodology is a bit all over the place with hospitalizations and ICU to be able to actually determine trends right now, which is, it's problematic, but it is what it is.
It's not ideal in this, especially when that seems like we're maybe in a situation where that those numbers are going to be moving. Derek, you were in the, you've been covering the First Minister's briefing for us all week. What has Nicola Sturgeon been saying this, and what's your instinct on whether she's minded towards more heavy-duty lockdown measures as an attempt to get to grips with these creeping cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately it's looking like a pretty grim position overall. Nicola Sturgeon has said that she's carefully considering, on a sort of ongoing basis, nationwide lockdown measures. As Leslie Ann said, we've seen 290 positive tests recorded overnight into Thursday. But of course, we don't completely know what to make of those figures because the issue of the rise in cases is being compounded by a backlog in the UK's Lighthouse Lab testing network. So we know that, and Nicola Sturgeon touched on this yesterday, we know that in some cases, people who had swabs taken last week still hadn't had the results as of yesterday afternoon.
Right.
And we also heard Nicola Sturgeon acknowledge that some people had been asked to travel away from their own town or city to get a test. So the problem with all of that is that it has a knock-on effect on contact tracing. So if we don't know for 4 or 5 days, or maybe even up to a week, who actually has coronavirus, then it means the Scottish Government aren't able to get in touch and warn their contacts to self-isolate, to get tested. And then you have people going around spreading the virus again without knowing about it. So you have community transmission going up again. So the First Minister yesterday also branded house parties as a danger to life. And of course, we know that house parties have been blamed for playing a pretty significant role in the cluster of cases we've seen popping up over recent weeks. So I think the obvious question people will have is whether we're moving kind of in the direction of having another nationwide lockdown.
Yeah.
Boris Johnson's been pretty strong in trying to rule that out, if at all possible. But we're already seeing things like curfews and pubs and restaurants, and that's something Nicola Sturgeon said she couldn't rule out for Scotland either. So it's obviously difficult to know where we're heading with things, but it certainly seems like, while it may not be a kind of full lockdown in name, if things don't improve pretty swiftly, we might see some pretty sweeping measures being brought in sooner or later. Jason Leach has talked about how in some other countries, you've seen things in a pretty similar position to where they're at now for Scotland and the UK, and then in about 8 or 10 weeks later, you start to see hospital cases going up and you start to see deaths rising. And that's because while the rise in cases seems to be predominantly among younger people at the moment, what inevitably happens is that they spread that to their grandparents and they spread it to other family members or they spread it to friends. And then actually that's when it becomes a real problem again in terms of hospital cases and in terms of deaths. So that's, I think that might be a case where in a few weeks from now, maybe the tone of the debate will change as well. And we could be kind of pushing more towards having quite sweeping measures.
I think you've put your finger on the big problem here, which is if we cast our mind back a few months to when we were coming out of the initial lockdown, both Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon were pretty upfront about the fact that the test and trace or test and protect scheme was the essential requirement of being able to ease the lockdown measures, because you had to be able to test and trace people quickly so they didn't spread the illness. And it just seems that from what you're describing there, that just isn't happening. That if people aren't getting their test result back for days, that system collapses. And it seems to me that it's hard to see how we can continue to open up society when the virus is still present and we're not able to trace people who potentially have it. Is that the brass tacks of it all?
Pretty much. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon was asked at a briefing whether it was an embarrassment for her or whether it was embarrassing for her, the kind of current situation in terms of testing. She didn't quite say that, but she said she wasn't happy about it. I think you've got the kind of incredible position where you had Dido Harding, who's in charge of the UK's tracing system, speaking yesterday about how, you know, the extent of people coming forward to get tested has been a bit of a shock to the system.
I think the exact quote was, "No one saw demand for tests coming."
Yeah,
which
I mean,
is mind-blowing.
You would have done if you'd looked to Scotland, because you saw in Scotland when schools went back, there was a huge surge in people going to get tests, and there's lots of reasons for that. You know, there's teachers going back and interacting with each other, there's parents standing at the school gates, there's kids who are 17 who logic would tell you probably are going to be about as susceptible as people who are 18.
Yeah.
So the idea that you wouldn't have any idea that this is coming just seems totally bizarre to me. So I think there probably is something that needs to be looked at there in terms of why things have fallen so far behind when Nicola Sturgeon had been, I mean, even in terms of schools going back in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon said she was going to carry on doing these, you know, 5 days a week briefings when schools go back. So we're obviously aware that there could be issues there. And then we've been talking about the kind of winter strain and how things are going to be there. So you'd think right from the beginning, they've been talking about the importance of having this testing capacity. I actually asked Jason Leach, weeks and weeks and weeks ago this was, there was kind of capacity available and they weren't testing people at this stage in care homes as much as some people thought they should be. And one of the things he talked about was bringing up this capacity so that then when schools go back, you do have that increased capacity. So I think it's been clear that testing has been important for a very long time, and yet we find ourselves in this position. So it's not ideal.
It seems that what you're describing is a failure of organisation and a failure of government, and it's not happy listening, but it's something that we'll keep tabs on as this process continues. Speaking of failures of government, I'll bring Dan O'Donoghue in here, who's been following the latest developments on the Brexit situation, in particular Boris Johnson and the UK government's internal market bill, which passed through the Commons this week and is still very controversial and hotly debated. Dan, can you bring us up to speed on what's been going on this week with that and the UK government's perhaps going to break international law?
Yeah, so this is the ongoing round about the internal market bill. I mean, the bill is basically designed to replace the legal framework of the EU single market that will leave at the end of the transition period on January 1st. It's a very broad bill, and it gives Westminster the power to kind of set food standards, set rules on state aid for businesses, and it gives ministers the power to invest in the same way that EU structural funds previously allowed. So that means London can spend in devolved areas, something that's really angered the SNP. But perhaps the thing that most people have noticed is basically a clause in the bill which allows ministers to override parts of last year's Brexit divorce deal and effectively means the UK will break international law. I mean, this comes down to basically rules around how goods pass from mainland GB to Northern Ireland and vice versa. I mean, there was a set of arrangements that were agreed to kind of prevent a hard border on the island of Ireland last year. And it seems that maybe Boris Johnson's only just read his own deal and realised that some of the provisions he's kind of agreed to last year means that there is an effective customs border in the Irish Sea. Not too happy with that, he's decided that, well, he basically has completely reneged on all the agreements, and that's caused an almighty stink in Brussels and internationally as well. Really, we've seen Joe Biden commenting on it today or yesterday. But the latest on this, so last week there was this almighty stink when it first kind of broke and what was going to happen, and then on I think at the start of this week we had a vote. It was a second reading vote. So when a bill's first introduced in the Commons, there's this 6-hour debate where MPs can kind of air their concerns, and then there's a vote as to whether the bill should basically continue its passage, and the government, obviously with a massive majority, comfortably won that vote. But I mean, there was a lot of damage caused. You had all sorts of really senior Tories coming out and saying, you know, this is completely not on, this is not what Britain should stand for, you know, reneging on international agreements. So what's happened this week, because the bill takes about 5-6 days to go through the Commons, so this, at the moment it's kind of really boring, kind of line-by-line legal debate, really. There's been kind of negotiations going on between Downing Street and some senior backbenchers who are not happy about kind of some of the provisions in there. And they've come to some kind of, well, a bit of a fudge, to be honest. The Downing Street have said, before we break international law and use any of these clauses, we'll give MPs a vote in the Commons to say that we can use these powers. I mean, again, when you've got a huge majority, that doesn't really mean a lot. And I mean, in Brussels, it's not really kind of allayed any fears that, you know, in the months ahead, we may well kind of row back on our commitments, basically.
I guess the issue is that there's kind of been a Rubicon crossed, because the UK government has said in
as a matter of principle, it's willing to break international law on this issue, whether or not it actually goes ahead and does it. I'm interested in what the reaction has been. You know, we've seen former Tory Prime Ministers John Major and Theresa May and David Cameron as well actually express concern about this. I don't want to draw this parallel too much, but I'm kind of reminded of Donald Trump with some of this, because it feels like there was a moment after Trump was elected where the Republican Party had a decision to make that whenever Trump broke the norms of international behavior or went beyond what the Republican Party would usually stand for and accept, whether they stood up against it or whether they just were swept along because Trump was in power and they didn't want to rock the boat. And it feels like this has maybe been a similar moment for the Conservative Party, because if you think of the Conservative Party and its traditional ideology, you know, conservatism is based on respect for institutions and respect for the rule of law and respect for international obligations. So to say that you're willing to break these things feels like it's flouting a lot of what traditional conservatism would identify itself with. And so I think that's why we have seen some turbulence, but there's not been a massive amount of turbulence really, has there, Dan? Or am I being unfair to some of the Tory backbenchers there?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, privately, I mean, there's been a few kind of, you know, older, more senior heads who've kind of, you know, willing to come out and speak publicly about this. But I mean, you know, some more kind of junior MPs have been willing to kind of privately say, you know, they're not very comfortable with this. I mean, of course, you've got kind of, you know, diehard Brexit fans who will kind of follow Boris Johnson to the end of the earth, and they don't really, they will kind of rip up everything in the process. They're not really bothered. But I think, you know, I think that there definitely will be, you know, a choice to be made, because this bill will be going into the Lords next week, and everyone expects the Lords to kind of take out these clauses. So it'll be a moment where, does the government put them back in, or does the government put them back in maybe completely changed and kind of softened? So it'll be another moment for MPs next week to kind of have another vote on it, really. But I think a lot of them are just quite scared to go against the grain with this. I mean, we saw what happened last year when, you know, Boris threw out, you know, former, you know, Ken Clark and Philip Hammond and all these other people who, you know, have served the party all their lives. He was willing to just kind of cast them aside and throw them out of the party for breaking the party line. So I think a lot of them, you know, are very keen to kind of, you know, toe the line on this. I mean, the ironic thing is with all of this is that the manifesto they stood on last year, you know, Boris made every single candidate sign an agreement to say that they would back his oven ready deal.
Yeah.
You know, now he's essentially ripped up that deal. So I don't know what they're meant to be standing for, but you know, it's absolutely crazy, to be honest.
Ed Miliband, I think Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, was self-isolating because of a COVID scare, I think, during that debate. And Ed Miliband, the former Labour leader, took his role. I think he scored some quite good points on that, didn't he? About the fact that, you know, it's Boris Johnson's deal signed in January, which is the thing that they're trying to break, which does seem pretty stark. The other thing I was thinking about was what's the mood music at Westminster? Is Dominic Cummings being seen as the man behind the scenes who's pulling the strings here? Is this being seen like his ploy, or is he not being considered involved in that?
Well, I think it seems from kind of some of the briefings that we've had around the Brexit talks in particular, you know, they're not going, you know, as planned as most people probably know. I mean, you know, they're kind of stalling, and a fair few people believe that this was an attempt, really, I suppose, to strong arm the EU and say, you know, look, give us the trade deal we're after or else. And it's just completely backfired. I mean, you know, the EU have kind of dug in on it and said, you know, this is completely not how we do business. And, the first thing on the agenda at the start of the informal talks the other week were kind of EU negotiators getting the UK to recommit to what it's already kind of signed up to, basically, before they'd carry on any trade talks. So it kind of gives you an idea, really, of how well things are going in the progress of these talks, you know, and also the fact that now we're kind of ramping up preparations again for a no deal. It just feels a bit like a merry-go-round, to be honest, the Brexit merry-go-round. Not very merry, but...
Yeah. And what about Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader? And I know that the SNP branded him spineless for not standing up to Boris Johnson over this. Has he been saying much?
Yeah, I mean, he's The Scottish Tories, they've come in for a lot of flak. I think Douglas was kind of quite out there in front, wasn't he, saying in his leadership pitch that he would stand, alone away from Westminster. I mean, when I previously spoke to him, you know, he was saying that he's not bothered about Downing Street. He doesn't check his phone for anything from them. He's not interested. And so, you know, the SNP were quick to pounce on him and say, you know, in all sorts of areas, I mean, whether it's kind of, you know, overreaching in the devolved spending or breaking international law or, you know, this bill is wholly inappropriate. And Douglas, I mean, he's been quite quiet on that. I mean, I think the Scottish Tories are going to have to, I think, come out with a bit more of a robust line, especially after, was it Lord Keane, the Advocate General for Scotland, quit over this, saying it wasn't legally sound. So, I mean, I think, again, they're going to keep coming in for questions over this as the bill progresses over the next week or so.
Yeah, okay. Actually, Tom, you've spoken to Douglas Ross this morning, haven't you? Did you speak to him about this issue?
I did mention this issue, yeah. And he said things. He said similar things to what he said before. He says that, you know, this UK internal market bill, you know, will support Scottish jobs and the economy, because, you know, that they're obviously, it does make sense to, after Brexit, to have, you know, to have free movement within the UK. So that's kind of the line he's been going on, that this needs to be done for the good of the economy, but there will be, you know, the chance to amend it later on.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with that if we do get to the stage of breaking international law, if the best defence is it'll protect jobs or what exactly happens with that. Speaking of this kind of constitutional division, we'll finish up now with a little chat about Scottish independence. It is 6 years today, as I'm speaking, since the independence referendum of 2014, which of course delivered a no result by 55% to 45%. The numbers have certainly changed since then, and it feels like a lot of the political ground has changed in Scotland as well. Let me start with you, Leslie Ann, because you've been looking at some of the polling on independence. What is the situation at the minute?
I think the pandemic has definitely not hurt the case for independence, and Nicola Sturgeon's kind of constant communicative presence about what's been going on with that has definitely not, in comparison to Boris Johnson, where even when there were daily briefings, it was a bit, where is he? That's definitely not hurt the situation. The kind of over time, when you look at since obviously the referendum, the lowest the polling went was in 2017, where the yes percentage went to around 39%.
Okay.
From late 2019 onwards, we've been seeing real progress in terms of the yes percentage increasing towards what Nicola Sturgeon's goal is, obviously. In October 2019, it was the first poll since the referendum where it had been 50-50, bang on. Since then, in 2020, I counted, we've got a poll tracker on our website, and on that, I've counted 13 polls in 2020 so far. One was 50-50, two had a slight no majority, and 10 had a yes majority. We're currently, in polls in the last month or so, sitting at around 53% yes.
Wow. You spoke to Sir John Curtis about that this week. Derek, what was he saying?
I did, yep. So he had some very interesting thoughts, actually. He was talking about what Leslie Ann was saying there about the kind of the polls. He was talking about how Brexit actually kind of hurt the SNP in 2017 because it wasn't quite as cut and dry at that point, that all their support would necessarily back Remain. But there's been a kind of shift in that more recently. So what he was talking about with me, so he was talking about whether the 2024 general election could be used as a sort of de facto independence referendum if Westminster rejects calls for a new vote from an SNP majority government next year, which the kind of current polls would tell you is the most likely outcome of the Holyrood election next year. So he was saying the SNP could consider running on a platform where winning a majority of Scottish seats at Westminster, or some other kind of dividing point would be regarded as grounds to kind of declare independence, begin negotiations to leave the UK straight away. And obviously be a kind of return to the party's official position prior to devolution, which was dropped kind of in a bid to make them more electable to people who might not be necessarily independence supporters, so that other people could kind of come on board. So John was in a kind of online debate with Dave Thompson, the former SNP MSP, now the leader of the, or interim leader of the Alliance for Independence group, the SNP deputy leader Keith Brown, and a few other individuals. And Dave Thompson had argued that a coalition of pro-independence parties, if they're able to secure more than half of the popular vote in next year's election, that in itself could actually be seen as a mandate for independence rather than just another referendum. Mm-hmm. And he said that could kind of lead to immediate negotiations to kind of achieve full and legal independence within a few years. John Curtis kind of ruled that out and said, Keith Brown also ruled that out. And both of them have said that the SNP are going to kind of stick to their Holyrood election plan, which will be to kind of win a majority and then begin talks for a second referendum. But he also touched upon kind of some of the reasons why these polls have been moving in the way that they have. So he singled out coronavirus as being the single biggest public policy issue in the history of devolution. And he predicted that could have a kind of major impact on any kind of push for independence, even after the election next year. So he talked about how kind of Brexit kind of did move the needle. So back, apparently, according to his analysis, back in 2014, there's a lot of kind of talk, especially kind of contemporaneously, about how EU feelings kind of affected people's votes. But he actually said that it really didn't have any effect on people's vote in 2014. It really just didn't come into it for a lot of people. You start to see it in 2016, but he said that you kind of see people moving in both directions. So you start to see people who are kind of leave voters and remain voters switching between yes and no. And in 2017, when you had the election, people were kind of put off. Some of those individuals were put off by the SNP's quite strong stance on the EU. So you actually saw that being a negative thing for the SNP in 2017. But last year, that started to change a little bit. And you started to see people moving from who are, whether they remain or leave, started to move towards a position of supporting independence. And a big reason, so that's just this year, sorry, and a big reason he suggests for that is the coronavirus handling and the way it's been done. So he said 20% of people who voted no in 2014 now believe the outbreak could have been handled better by an independent Scotland, which is a pretty kind of
that's a
remarkable figure, really, isn't it, when you think about it?
A fifth.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. So he said it doesn't appear to be to do with Brexit now, that kind of jump, because there does seem to be this on both the Leave side and the Remain side. So those are the two big factors that he's kind of picked out as being, for last year it was Brexit, this year it's coronavirus, and that's why you're seeing that big kind of push towards support for independence.
Okay, that's really interesting, Derek. Thank you. Tom, you covered the first referendum on the front line.
As did yourself, of course.
Yeah. I did. Yeah. What's your reflections on it 6 years on? What do you remember, or what do you feel's changed, or how do you feel about it looking back?
Well, looking back, I think it was almost as a journalist, it was one of these sort of defining things that went on for ages. And I mean, I speak of someone who's bricked himself in Afghanistan and embedded with Scottish troops, and I did 2 years at Arbroath Sheriff Court. We're all very exciting, but nothing could possibly compare with the Scottish independence referendum of 2014, which was incredibly exciting, incredibly fraught, challenging, and incredibly busy to cover. What I remember is just running around all over the place, and it was one of these sort of moments when, you know, in politics, there's always a lot going on, but on days and during the independence referendum, it just felt that it was sort of overwhelming, the amount of stories that were sort of breaking that you were trying to handle and choosing which ones to. So from a professional point of view, it was challenging, exciting, and quite fraught. I don't know how you remember it, David.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's certainly the biggest professional challenge I think that I've experienced, because there was the weight of it, because it was such a massive electoral decision, and you wanted to get it right and inform people properly. And it was such an emotional and, as you say, fraught debate.
Yeah. That I think that was, and the people that were, you know, you had, it was obviously your own country as well, the country you live in. There was an emotional thing as well.
There was that. And also, I guess, we were early in the days of social media, really, at that stage. And you know, that became, it became one of the first electoral events where the conversation was primarily carried out on social media. And that brought extra challenges from a journalism perspective. The good news is, Tom, is it looks like we might get to do it all over again pretty soon. Is that something you're looking forward to?
Well, obviously, I look forward to the excitement of it. It might not be a few years yet.
Yeah.
Journalists love a story, don't they? I mean,
I have a suspicion that the independence debate will keep paying both of our mortgages for a while yet. I've run out of time, so I'm going to finish here. But I'll maybe ask the younger members of the panel where they were this day 6 years ago. Leslie Ann Kelly, what's your memory of that day?
I remember getting up early because I had to vote, and then I had to get a train to Glasgow to go to a trade union event because I was a trade union officer at the time.
There we go.
And then I remember sitting in a park in Glasgow afterwards, and there was just quite a lot of madness going around, quite a lot of kind of parade and kind of very party-like atmosphere. I think there was definitely a feeling that it was going to go the other way in Glasgow anyway.
Well, I suppose it did go the other way in Glasgow.
Yeah.
Derek, where were you 6 years ago?
I was a student journalist and very disappointed not to be kind of covering this huge, biggest in a generation vote. So who could have known just 6 years later we'd be looking at possibly doing it all over again. I was also in Glasgow, and I think the feeling there was, I picked up the same kind of feeling. I thought it was going to go the other way as well. There seemed to be a kind of big momentum towards that, which is obviously kind of as told in the result in Glasgow. I did think it was going to go the other way as well at that stage.
It's interesting. And Dan, were you paying much attention to Scottish politics 6 years ago?
Back then I was working for the Manchester Evening News. I mean, I distinctly remember I was living in a house share with kind of six other people, and we did an all-nighter watching the BBC News coverage, just fascinated by it, to be honest. So yeah, I had no idea I'd one day work for a Scottish paper and all this would still be going on. But yeah, that was where I was. Yeah.
Well, I suspect if there's a second independence referendum soon, you will not be in Manchester for covering it. So you can look forward to being somewhere more on the front line on Indyref 2. Anyway, we could talk about that all day, I think, but we best bring it to a close. So for this week, I will thank Dan, Derek, Leslie Ann and Tom for joining me. I'll thank you for listening. And for the Stooshy, I've been David Clegg. Cheers.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day online and in print to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.